Welcome, everybody, to Breaking Kayfabe. I'm your host, Jeff Bowden. With me, my co-host, the wild man from the Sudan, Barry the Butcher Rose. Barry, how's it going?
The Butcher, the two best friends you never knew you had. We are back. It's another episode. I'm super pumped, Jeff. This is the one that you have been talking about with me, oh, I'll say 6 months privately, and then publicly for maybe the last 3 weeks. And I kept saying, I'm just not ready, Jeff. I'm just not ready. Well, I had a 24-hour binge fest of one of our favorite shows of all time, Jeff. What is it?
I can't imagine what you're talking about. Of course, we're talking about The Office, not the UK version. We're going to maybe discuss that in a little bit of detail, but we are talking about the American version of The Office, starring Steve Carell, Rainn Wilson. We're going to talk about our top five favorite episodes. Personally, don't get all, you know, your panties in a knot there. This isn't what the critics say the best episodes are, or Greenbaum says the best episode is. This is our personal choices. And along with that, we are going to be looking. Barry had a chance recently, had something pop up on the old YouTube page, and I looked at it and I went, holy crap, how did somebody find this? We are going back to Cleveland, Ohio, 1974. Antonio Inoki, the NWF champ, facing off with the big cat, Ernie Ladd, and we will discuss that. Barry, you about ready to go? Because we're not going to just break kayfabe on the wrestling business. We'll break kayfabe on sports, movies, television, music, pop culture. We are, in fact, going to break kayfabe on life! What did you say, Barry? Ready to go?
Jeff, that was maybe the best break kayfabe on life. What was that last week? Was that Richard Singer? I forget who it was that requested that, but my God, I think you just made up for that tenfold. That was excellent.
I like to think that I accommodate the good folks on our message board at Breaking Kayfabe with Bowden and Barry, the best message board for wrestling fans and fans of pop culture, music, television, all that crap, Barry. So you ready to go?
I'm ready to go.
Okay, Barry, we're going to start off with something. It has come to my attention as we record this show, folks. You know, it is the summer and we're recording sort of off schedule, if you will. So when this comes out, it will have been a few weeks. But we yesterday, as we record this, acknowledged the 30th anniversary. 30 years, Barry. Good Lord. 30 years, the anniversary of the death, some would say the homicide, of Frank Goodish, Bruiser Brody, in Bayamon, Puerto Rico, at a wrestling show. The story, don't really need to go into it. It's out there for those of you who want to do your research on it. And for God's sakes, if you haven't, what have you been waiting for? Barry, what I wanted to talk to you about is some own personal memories that you have of Brody. Of course, you being our CWF expert, talk maybe a little bit about Brody's time spent in the Florida during the CWF days, that kind of thing. And some personal memories you have of Brody.
Yeah, so I got to say, too, so I was really bummed out when Brody was killed. And a lot of it, I guess at the time, he was my favorite wrestler in 1988. So, you know, there wasn't a lot that was going on. The WWF wasn't really an alternative for wrestling. NWA certainly was. But 88, you know, Brody was such an iconic figure. And I was really, really bummed out when I heard the story. Obviously, as the story progressed and I got a little bit older, the fact that he left a young child and you know, and his wife and all that, certainly from a personal aspect, was just terrible. But he's an iconic figure in wrestling, and he's really interesting to me. I first saw him live in 1975. He came into Florida underneath his legitimate name, which is Frank Goodish, and he was Frank the Hammer Goodish. And he came in and he maybe had the greatest debut of all time in the state of Florida. His first match took place on television and he won the Florida title. That's how he made his debut. And in winning the Florida title, it was a squash. He beat Rocky Johnson. It was a pure squash match, and it was unlike anything I think we had ever seen. We were all shocked. I know I was shocked, and especially seeing, because Rocky at that point, if Rocky was doing a job, it was a competitive match. Rocky was not a guy that anybody squashed in the state of Florida. So he had won the title maybe a week or two earlier, didn't have it for too long. And Brody came in, Goodish. We had no idea who this guy was. And he was this unstoppable monster that just destroyed Rocky and became the new Florida champion. And I think I was 11 years old, maybe 12. So I was devastated. That was one of my favorites right there. I was devastated. And Goodish stuck around, I'll say, for maybe 4 or 5 months. But for whatever reason, he wasn't a favorite of the office. And I can't really, a nice little reference there of the office. But I can't really figure out what happened and why it went down the way it was. He won the Florida title in a convincing fashion and then really spent the rest of his time middle of the card. You know, there was a few times when he had main events, maybe in the smaller towns, but as far as things like Miami and Tampa and stuff, he really wasn't in the main events. He was in the middle of the card, maybe sometimes even prelims, as the Florida champion. I had a chance, I interviewed Rocky, I guess about a year ago, maybe a little bit less, and I was writing an article on Killer Kowalski, who came in at the same time as Brody in 75, and we were talking about that, and I asked Rocky, I said, so how was it, you know, when you found out that you were going to be losing the Florida title on TV to a guy who was really a virtual unknown at this point? And he said, I had no issue with it. Business was business. They asked me, you know, a title, you give it to me, you take it away, whatever it is, I'm going to do whatever you want. Somebody that knows, that knew Killer Kowalski pretty well, relayed his story to me. A guy named William DeKoff, who was a wrestler for years too. I forget what name he actually worked under. He's a police officer now. And he had trained under Kowalski, and he had basically said Kowalski was very similar. Kowalski came in 75, stayed roughly the same time as Brody, late 75, and then maybe till spring of 76, and he got the Southern title, but the same thing. He really wasn't in the main events, and Kowalski relayed to William a conversation he had with Brody, and it went something like, this makes no fucking sense what they do here. They give you a title, then they farm you out to these small towns where you can't draw money. It's an effort to get you out of the state, and you got to get out of here. And Kowalski, I guess, was responsible for getting Brody up in New York, where he actually became Brody. And part of that was based off of the time that they spent together in Florida. Brody came back. He came back in the 80s. He was around in the early 80s, formed a tag team with Big John Studd. And then we saw him in the late 80s when he was kind of doing his vagabond thing, where he would just move territory to territory and had that infamous match, which is all over YouTube, with Lex Luger, which a lot of people call a shoot, and it's not really a shoot if you've ever seen the match. And maybe calling it a match isn't accurate either, because it's not really a match, but it's two guys get into a cage, and one guy, I guess, is getting ready to go to Crockett, and the other guy, who is Brody, just decides he's not going to sell, and that's exactly what happens in the match. So doesn't make any sense, but I was such a fan of Brody, and I realize he's a polarizing figure to some. You know, he destroyed towns, apparently, that, you know, some feel that he wasn't professional. But at the end of the day, you know, his death was a real tragedy. And I remember where I learned about his death. I don't know. Where did you learn about it, Jeff?
Now that I'm thinking about it, I believe, I don't know if I got a call from Dave Meltzer or not, or if I read about it in the Observer. It might have been a phone call from Meltzer.
Yes, I was watching television, and it was on Entertainment Tonight, and they were actually discussing this story on Entertainment Tonight. So it made national television. It wasn't just, quote unquote, a wrestling story. It was much, much, much bigger. But, you know, his wife, Barbara Goodish, has done a couple of podcasts. And maybe it's a guest that we would consider having on, but she answered the question about, you know, this has always been the question, would he have gone to the WWF as an opponent for Hulk Hogan at the point? I believe she answered that the question was yes, that, you know, I guess there was some sort of a conversation. The wheels were in motion. There was something to it. So that would have been really interesting. I think for us as, you know, the smart marks, that would have been disheartening to see Brody, you know, the last rebel, kind of doing the job to the leg drop. But at the same time, I think we also realize wrestling is wrestling. So, yeah.
Well, and I will tell you that, not to give props to a non-Arcadian Vanguard podcast, but I just happened to be listening to Talk is Jericho today, and he had Dave Meltzer on, and they were discussing that very issue. And I believe, because I think Frank and Dave spoke fairly regularly, that Dave said the fact the wheels were in motion, but you have to remember that Brody had also started a pro, was, I shouldn't say started, was just getting ready at the time of his death to start a program in All Japan with a promoter, Giant Baba, that would ultimately have led to him having some sort of singles confrontation. I don't know if it would have been a long program, but there was going to be a singles match between he and Stan Hansen, which to the Japanese fans would have been an unbelievable dream match. And then, of course, after that was over, I think he would have gone to the WWE. He would have made huge money. And he would have, in fact, done the leg drop. Dave's point was that after that happened, he would have gone back because he wouldn't have stayed long after he took the pin from Hogan. He would not be one of these guys that worked his way down the card. And he would have eventually, probably, according to Dave, have ended up working in ECW because that would have been the ultimate style. And then he could have, you know, eventually just probably left on his own terms. And of course, that is something that we will never, in fact, know. But the Talk is Jericho episode with Dave discussing the career of Frank Goodish, Bruiser Brody, is actually very compelling stuff. You know, Dave does the history so very well. And, you know, for all the problems that people have with Dave and, oh, is this a 5-star match or a 4¾? He really is such a preeminent historian of the business and is able to look at things and put things in context. Barry, stop the presses. Do you know what time it is, Barry? Yes, it's everyone's favorite time. On Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry. Guess what time it is, Barry?
It's time for me. I'm either going to fuck, kill, or marry somebody right now.
No, properly put in its form, Barry. It's fuck the marry, kill. Now you're taking it out of sequence. So, Barry, since last episode we discussed Boogie Nights, I'm going to give you a Boogie Nights question.
Oh.
This is a tough one. Barry, F, marry, or kill Heather Graham, Julianne Moore, or Nina Hartley?
Well, it as much. All right. So, as much as I've wanted to F Nina Hartley previously, because let's be honest, she's been a porn star now for some 30 or 35 years, and
she's what they call a pro, Barry.
She's a pro. She is what they call a pro, but she still looks really, really good. The last I saw her, and she's got to be in her mid to late 50s but I am going to kill her. And why is that? Because if there's two actresses that I've had crushes on in Hollywood, it's Heather Graham and it's Julianne Moore. I am going to F Julianne Moore, and I'm going to F as long as I could possibly F Julianne Moore. And then I'm going to marry Heather Graham just so I can F Heather Graham all the time as well, because I've had a crush on her for years. That's a really, really tough one right there. What a fantastic movie Boogie Nights was as well.
And I will say that Heather Graham has now entered rarefied air here on Breaking Kayfabe. She is our first two-time contestant and has Mary and Kill Barry. So she must be something special. Barry, now got to tell you a little courthouse story of the day. You said that folks have asked before about my courthouse stories. Had a great one today, Barry. So I'm coming back from court late this morning and see a friend of mine. You know, our offices are on the second floor. We have a series of escalators that go up to the fourth floor. And I'm walking past the escalator and I see a friend of mine. They say, oh, did you see what happened there? I'm like, what are you talking about? I just got out of court. Lady coming down from the second floor to the first floor on the escalator gets the heel of the shoe caught at the bottom on the first floor. Okay. Now, this is not something that is not terribly unusual. However, what made it a great courthouse story, Barry, was as they are trying to get her foot out of her shoe so they could, you know, not hurt, you know, not get herself hurt, because I actually have had a friend that had surgery based on an incident that happened on an escalator. This woman's statement to the police officers that are trying to extricate her foot from the shoe that's caught in the escalator, she says, whatever you do, don't break the shoe. That is a $2,000 shoe. Which leads me to the question, Barry, does Mrs. Rose have any $2,000 shoes?
No, absolutely not.
Who buys a pair of shoes for too large, Barry? I was like, what the F? I just couldn't believe that one. So, yeah, that's my official courthouse story of the day. So now, Barry, it is time for us. We're going to go to 1974, Cleveland, Ohio. Barry, it's the NWF, the old Johnny Powers promotion. I believe, was it Pedro Martinez that was the promoter up there, Barry?
Yeah, so I don't know if Pedro was out by this point, but yeah. So that whole Buffalo-Cleveland area, first it was Pedro Martinez. Actually, it was somebody prior to Pedro. It was Pedro Martinez for years, and then Powers took it over when it was the NWF. But I think by 74, I think we were seeing Powers at this point.
And I believe what happened is I think Antonio Inoki bought their world title. And,
correct,
of course, he had many hopes and dreams for years of being perceived as a true world champion. So he buys the world title from the NWF. He comes over to Cleveland, and he faces off with the Big Cat, Ernie Ladd. Barry, tell us what you thought about this match.
Yeah, I actually wanted to talk about Heather Graham and Julianne Moore some more. So maybe we could do a special episode at some point and discuss those two, because that I could do that all day long. So I like this match too. This is interesting to me. So as you mentioned, it takes place in Cleveland, which really was Cleveland Buffalo was kind of the hub, for the Martinez promotion for years. And then Powers, I think, either bought into it or bought it outright. And then he accepted some sort of offer from Antonio Inoki to sell the world title. And I want to say it was like $50,000. At the time, that was a pretty large amount. I don't know if he ever got paid, but it's an odd match. And, you know, the first thing, you and I had a conversation about this match, and you said, you know, one guy's a heel and then the crowd turns. And I don't know. I wasn't sure what I was seeing at times, because really this was, to me, this was a babyface wrestling match to start off with, for sure. And it's very hard for me to see who's the heel here, who's the baby face. And yeah, there's moments where Ernie Ladd comes off as the heel, but you know, you and I have seen Ernie Ladd hundreds of times. This wasn't that Ernie Ladd. This was a guy that was actually wrestling. There's a lot of mat wrestling. I'll tell you one interesting thing too. Ladd was taking these really smooth arm drags from Inoki, and they were as smooth and impressive as I've ever seen. And for a guy that, you know, I think Ladd was, what, 6'8", 6'7", 6'6", 6'9"? He's somewhere in the neighborhood right there. He's taking these arm drags like he's like Jack Briscoe. I thought that was absolutely incredible. There's another great spot where Inoki's got Ladd trapped in a leg scissors lock around his head. Ladd lifts him up and drops him into the corner turnbuckle, which is, I think that's a Seth Rollins move currently, the turnbuckle bomb. That was really interesting. The booking is kind of odd. So the first fall ends where both men can't get to their feet by the 10 count. And it's a 2 out of 3 falls match. So really odd to me. I guess it's a double count out. I don't know. It's a double knockout. And then Ladd wins the second fall and then basically takes the belt and leaves the ring and heads back to the dressing room. The referee starts to count him out. And as he's counting him out, I guess, I don't know if this was intentional or not, Ladd realizes and he sprints back to the ring like I've never seen him ever sprint. Inoki attacks him as he's coming into the ring and basically pins him and he gets the belt. I'm assuming at this point the fans are unhappy because while they had thrown some of the garbage and cups in the ring earlier, they just start pelting the ring at this point. So it was a really unique match. It's definitely got that 70s vibe. I really enjoyed it. It's a little confusing. Shot in Cleveland, but it's got Japanese commentary to it. So I would have liked, I think, to understand what was going on or what they were saying, because it really is. My assumption, you're right, Inoki was supposed to be the baby face and Ladd's supposed to be the heel, though a subtle heel, I think, for whatever the reasoning was. But at the same time, I think Inoki, you know, they're throwing the garbage when Inoki wins. Like, nobody's happy about it. And that, to me, is odd, that you would take a guy and bring him over here. And I forget, I had this conversation. You know who referenced this? Bob Backlund in his book. Do you remember that chapter when he talked about Inoki?
Not right off the top of my head. Refresh me.
So what he said, and I think it actually plays here, is that Inoki wanted to come over and he wanted to main event in the Garden, and he was making this hard play for a main event match in the Garden, and Vince saw that there was no money in that. you know, the fans were not vested in him. The fans didn't know who he was. Him showing up for one match didn't mean squat. You know, it was, they had to see him on a weekly basis, and he had to do interviews, and he didn't want to do either of those. So I kind of get the feeling that with Inoki, and I know Inoki had a couple of matches in the Cleveland area, but it's probably pretty similar where, you know, a guy who's a top babyface in Japan wants to come over here and thinks that he can come over here and be a top babyface and only work a couple of matches, and it didn't work. That's what I saw. That being said, I really enjoyed the match, though, because it does have this really cool 70s vibe to it. They're doing a lot of 70s holds. And seeing Ladd looked really, really good here, I thought.
Yeah, couple things I noted about the match. This was 2 years before the Inoki Muhammad Ali fight. So here was Inoki coming over to the United States, as you said, trying to get in the beginning of the match. And if I'm going to post the match on our Facebook group, when you watch the match, if you know, for those of you that'll take a moment and watch this, it's very odd at the beginning because the crowd cheers Ernie Ladd. Tell him I said hello. And So they cheer Ernie Ladd, and they're kind of booing Inoki. I guess they think he's going to be the traditional Japanese heel. But then the match starts, and then, you know, like you said, Ladd starts doing more subtle heel stuff. But I will say this. Inoki is one of the all-time great guys at working a crowd. He really has a feel for the crowd and that ability to adjust to the way the crowd's thinking and the way the crowd's reacting to different things. He really is very, very good at doing that. And I'm not poo-pooing Ernie Ladd, one of the great heels in the history of the business, but the way that Inoki turns the crowd with Ladd's help, without any question, was just amazing. And to think that this was 2 years before Inoki is on the world stage as, you know, this guy facing Muhammad Ali. And of course, and that ended up ultimately being a complete disaster. But, what is it about Cleveland fans during the 70s? You know, you think about it, you had the famous match that involved Ernie Ladd and Ox Baker. You remember that stadium match where like a legitimate riot? So apparently the Cleveland fans had a history of some angry behavior. And at the end of this match, they absolutely cover the ring in paper cups and garbage, Barry. It was completely horrible.
Yeah, that was Antonio Inoki on the phone that was calling me, by the way. So somehow he's gotten wind.
Yeah, we'll tell him we said hello.
Yeah, but so to that end, you know, you're right about Inoki, too. So the Muhammad Ali thing was horrific. I actually, my father took me to a local hotel in Miami Beach that was showing it on closed circuit television that night. And there was several hundred people there, and it's unwatchable. And it was very disappointing. And I think I was one of the few people that was there that night that was pulling for Inoki. I was a wrestling guy. Almost everybody else was involved as far as boxing. So, you know, just a really, really disappointing match. I really can't blame Inoki based off the circumstances. But to that end also, I think that every time that Inoki, at least in this country, has been on the big stage, it hasn't been overly successful. Certainly more success in some matches than others, but at the same time, he never cracked the U.S. market. It never, and I think that was always a goal of his, and that never happened. But this is fun, and you're right about Cleveland fans, too. I think that was the night that Ernie Ladd turned, right? In that match?
It must have been. And as you said, the first fall goes about 15 minutes. There's a double knockout. The second fall happens, I want to say, about 20 minutes in. It's about a 30-minute match, but it happens about 28 minutes in. And like Barry says, I think Ladd maybe gave him a couple of the big where he holds his foot up and Inoki runs into the foot, and he gives him two of those. Inoki shockingly lays there for the three count, which just amazed me, Barry. If you know anything about Inoki, that's something he very rarely does. And then Ladd leaves, comes sprinting back to the ring, and it's like within 15 seconds, Inoki pins him, and somehow Inoki leaves with, you know, it was kind of a crazy finish. It is what is known in the business as some kind of schmoz, because that's what it was. But yeah, as a historical piece, it's really an interesting time capsule. In the same way that the Fritz von Erich Giant Baba match was, I think this was not quite up to that level. But God, if nothing else, watching the people in Cleveland just completely pelt the ring with paper cups, it was just the ring was just filled with garbage. It was just absolutely amazing. Okay, Barry, I started thinking we're going to start this top five earlier than we usually do because we really want to do a deep dive on this subject. And I figured that, Barry, we have spent time on this show talking about Seinfeld, talking about Stranger Things, and now it is time for Joshua Greenbaum's dream to come true because we are talking about The Office, Barry.
We're talking about The Office. And again, you know, I just want to point out that Jeff has been on me for probably 6 months to do it. And I searched Netflix last night and I could not find it. And I wanted to pull up certain episodes and I believe it's off of Netflix. However, my on-demand service locally had a bunch of episodes and I spent about 3 hours watching The Office last night. So it was kind of a refresher. You know, this was the other part. I haven't watched The Office since it's gone off the air, and it's been 5 years. It went off in I didn't realize. I thought it was like 2 years ago. It's been off since 2013.
Yeah, that's crazy. So here's what we're going to do. Before we discuss our favorite episodes, I threw a couple questions about this program to Barry. And with the benefit of having listeners outside the continental U.S., as we discussed, let me just, for those outside the continental U.S. who have never seen this show, let me just tell you about the premise of the show is that a documentary film crew are going to do a documentary on a sort of mid-level paper company in the middle of anywhere in the United States, and they pick a mid-level paper product company called Dunder Mifflin. And the manager of the office is a guy named Michael Scott. And he is ably assisted by the assistant to the regional manager, or is it assistant regional manager? Dwight K. Schrute is one of the other main characters, along with Jim Halpert. Pam Beasley is the receptionist. Jim Halpert is a salesperson. And there are many other characters that you will get to know over the course of the years. So, based on that, first question for you, Barry. Barry, tell me your favorite character on The Office.
And it's a tough one, too. Because, you know, the truth is I've got so many favorite characters, but I'm going to go with one of the main characters as opposed to one of the, I guess, lesser characters. And I'll say it's Jim Halpert. So I like Jim. And much like I think everybody that watched the show, everybody kind of resonated with Jim a little bit. He was kind of the everyman. You know, there were ups, there were downs. He was a guy that was in a kind of stuck in a job, you know, and I think there was a lot of similarities. And I know that when I watched The Office, I would go, yeah, Jim's like, he's a cool guy. He's, you know, he's trying to find himself in a sense. He's obviously he's in love with this woman. But yeah, I was able, there was a lot of similarities there and, it would probably be Jim. But I all got to say, I love Kevin too. For whatever reason, whenever Kevin came on the screen, I would invariably always start to laugh.
Well, I think in the context of the show, I think Jim was basically the way the viewer was looking at this this office. It was through Jim's eyes because, you know, Jim was the one offering the running commentary. There was this very funny scene that I recall when they had the episode, the Booze Cruise, where Jim says, you know, I am guaranteeing that within, I don't know, 30 minutes of taking off, that Michael Scott will go to the front of the ship and, you know, do the whole Titanic pose. And then, of course, Michael does exactly that. Jim is shot from far away by the film crew and is pointing at his watch saying, yes, I nailed it. He did exactly what I said. So in that way, Jim is really the eyes of the camera. He's, you know, we're looking at the office through Jim's eyes. And so I can absolutely understand. Now, I'll get back to Jim because there's some more questions I want to ask you about that particular character. I think my favorite character was Dwight K. Schrute because he was just so bizarre and such an odd character. Such a he began as such a sycophant. You know, he was such a brown noser for the boss, and he was such a guy that wanted control. And the way that Dwight evolved over the show, as someone pointed out to me, Dwight started off as basically the lead heel of the show and evolved into a baby face over the course of, you know, the run of the show. But, he was, a guy that had a farm outside of town that grew beets.
The beet farmer.
With cousin Moe's. And, who's another great, very minor character. But I would say Dwight K. Schrute. What were your thoughts on Dwight K. Schrute, as played by the great Ryan Wilson, by the way?
Yeah, and I love Dwight because he was such a unique character. And really, I think a lot, for me, a lot of the highlight, at least the crux of the early years, was the relationship between Jim and Dwight. It really wasn't, to me, it wasn't about Michael or Dwight or Michael and Jim, but the interaction between and the constant, you know, back and forth between those two, I just thought was fantastic. Rainn Wilson is such a great actor, too. He was in a show that was really one of the forerunners of pay television as far as great episodic TV shows, which was a show that aired on HBO called 6 Feet Under. And he was on for several years. And when I saw him on The Office, I was very excited. And yeah, he was just, you know, the whole beet farming thing was great. And he was just so unusual. And yeah, I love him. I love Dwight.
And he was also, and I'm sitting here, God, why can't I think of the movie that he was in? God, it was one of my Almost Famous. God dang it, I was having trouble thinking.
Yeah.
He was one of the guys who worked for Rolling Stone magazine in the movie Almost Famous. So yeah, very good character actor. Jim Halpert, of course, is played by John Krasinski. John Krasinski recently with a movie, A Quiet Place, that I believe he directed that also. And got tremendous reviews, and it's really nice to see a lot of times TV actors get stuck in character. You know, it's the McLean Stevenson effect. Your McLean Stevenson, no matter what he did the rest of his career, was Colonel Henry Blake and from MASH. And so John Krasinski has made it, you know, he's branched out. He's doing this. He's going to become Jack Ryan, you know, in a role that was made famous by Harrison Ford and Alec Baldwin, you know, Tom Clancy character. And he's doing I think it's on Netflix, a series where he's Jack Ryan, which is kind of interesting. Yeah. So next question for you regarding The Office, tell me your least favorite character.
Yeah. This one's actually a little bit easier too. So it really comes down to two. So it would be Nellie. I absolutely couldn't stand Nellie. I didn't like her as a character. I just didn't like her on the show. Kelly Kapoor is another one. And Kelly, Kelly was basically around for the entire series. But Kelly with the, ditzy kind of, just very unintelligent. I think it just played. I know she's very intelligent. She's a powerhouse in Hollywood with her own show for years. But the character just started to grate on me after a while. But I didn't like Nellie at all. I don't know if she falls into that mate. She was only around for, 3 years? But just something about her, I don't know if it was her British accent. She didn't gel in the show to me, and I couldn't connect with her at all.
I will tell you that the correct answer is, in fact, Kelly Kapoor. Because
okay, so we're right there. All right.
Mindy Kaling is absolutely a very accomplished writer. And I have to tell you, Kelly Kapoor is a perfect example of taking a minor character and expanding her role to the point where she becomes tiresome. And I'll give you a comparison, though this person's role is not as bad. But it was the way that towards the end of the run of the show that Seinfeld was making Kramer so much more of a big part of the show. I mean, he was one of the four main characters, but – you know, Michael Richards' role of Kramer became so much more expanded than it was at the beginning of the run. And it was great at the beginning when he would just do those entries where he'd walk through the door and the crowd would pop, the studio audience. And so they began expanding, and it made him more and more odd and just more and more weird. And to the point, I remember the stupid – I'll never forget the Kenny Rogers episode of Seinfeld.
Where, Kenny Rogers Roasters.
Yeah, that was just so stupid.
The word that makes it good. Yeah. I like that episode. You didn't like that one?
It was stupid where he's up on the roof and he's suntanning and he's covering himself with butter.
Yeah.
And
butter.
It was just odd. But, and that's what happened. But anyway, getting back to The Office, what happened was they expanded – at the first couple seasons, I thought Kelly Kapoor was a very funny character. And then she began getting involved with Ryan. And Ryan and her, as the romance started blossoming and she became more and more the annoying girlfriend, she really just started grating. It was like fingernails on a chalkboard kind of stuff.
Yeah, well, to that end, I might be wrong. And maybe some members of our group were clamoring for more Kelly Kapoor, but I don't think there was this big outcry where people had to see it. If I'm correct, she actually became some sort of a producer on the show. And
oh yeah, definitely. Feeling,
yeah, so I think as you know, as they all did, a lot of them got involved. But I think as she got more power, that character expanded. And I agree with you. It just in small doses, it was fine. But you know, that's you just touched on something that I find really interesting about Seinfeld and Kramer, etc. That's been going on forever. Happy Days was never supposed to be about the Fonz. Good Times was never supposed to be about J.J. Walker, but Jimmy Walker and J.J. But I think what happens, obviously, is that, you know, if one of these characters kind of takes off and people attach themselves to the character, the studios obviously are going to, like, give you as much as you want. And I think that's what happened with somebody like Kramer.
Well, and it's funny because you just said Happy Days. Here's another extremely dated reference. Laverne and Shirley was never supposed to be about Lenny and Squiggy. And as the show, you know, and I'll tell you another thing, Happy Days was never supposed to be about Joni and Chachi, but all the characters began aging out and then they get their own spinoff, you know, but so it's not something that's completely a rare phenomenon in Hollywood and in television. It happens all the time. But in this case, I really thought the show suffered when they began focusing more and more on Kelly and making her more of a major character in the show. Okay, next question, Barry. Tell me, and I think you may have already revealed this, Mr. Spoiler, tell me your favorite minor office character.
Yeah, that's real easy for me. It's Creed. Creed is...
Oh, I thought you were going to say Kevin, because you just talked about how much you love Kevin.
No, I love... Well, I think I spoiled that with you last night, because when I was texting you last night, I'm like, is Creed considered a minor character? I love Kevin, but to me, Creed, if Creed had gotten a spinoff, I'd be watching every single week. He was so creepy. His lines, which, you know, obviously I don't think he was writing his own material, but at the same time, his delivery was so good. You know, and he would say these off the wall, creepy things. You know, I remember this one, they're talking about the Taliban and he goes, the Taliban's the worst. Great heroin though. You know, and nobody steals from Creed Bratton and gets away with it. The last person to do this disappeared. His name, Creed Bratton. So he was always doing and saying these things. And, you know, one of my episodes, I'm not going to give it away right now, but in one of the episodes that I chose, he's got one of the great lines of all time, I think, but just such a unique guy. And isn't he like a musician in real life?
Well, and he was a guy, I believe he played with the Grassroots back in the 60s, right, which is a really popular band. And it's really, you know, one of the things that's great about the character is exactly what you said. There's so much that it's like peeling an onion. There's so many layers to this character that, you know, and what I thought was great about this character and the way they wrote the character was they would write the character and do like inside jokes. Like when he says, and this is not the name of the guy, but when he says, you know, like, the line you just referenced, what was it where he said, you know, the last guy that messed with Creed Bratton was Creed Bratton. And he shows an ID and he said, yeah. And his character's real name was like William Hutchinson or something like that, which is apparently like Creed Bratton's real name in real life before he joined the Grassroots, which is so out there obscure that I love that kind of shit that they just make a reference that like maybe five people get until they start doing a real, you know, like when you look at the DVD extras and they reveal something like that to you. I just love when they do that kind of crap.
Yeah, it was. And that's, I think The Office was really, really good. And they were kind of the forerunners. You know, there was a lot of shows that came afterwards. Certainly Parks and Recreations was, you know, even though it's a spinoff in a sense, you know, it's definitely a similar type of show. But The Office was really the forerunner of doing stuff like that.
So my favorite minor character, and this is the ultimate minor character on this show, and that is Bob Vance Refrigeration. And one of the things I love about that is there was a great, I can't remember the episode, where Bob Vance, who plays Phyllis's fiance, then husband, is being introduced to the office. And he goes up, and as he's being introduced, oh, hi, I'm Kevin. Bob Vance, Vance Refrigeration. And he goes over to Stanley, Bob Vance, Vance Refrigeration. And then he goes up to Ryan, Bob Vance, Vance Refrigeration. And Ryan goes, what kind of work you in there, Bob? And he turns and just kind of looks at the camera sideways. And it was just such a great scene because all that guy cared about, he knew he was on a documentary because he was going to put his company over, by God.
And there's nothing wrong with that. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
So, yeah, no, he was just a very funny, extremely minor character. There were so many great other, you know, I could have picked Kevin or I could have picked Stanley. But to me, he was like a one-trick pony, but that one trick just always served to crack me up. Okay, next question. And this is one, if you go on YouTube and you type in this question, holy crap, will you get the videos. Very important question to ask you, Barry. Was Toby Flenderson the Scranton Strangler?
This is a very important question and a very, very tough question. And much like you just said, it's multi-layered. I believe the answer is yes. I think Toby was. And if you do, so I watched those videos on YouTube, and there's certainly plenty of articles. There's entire websites just dedicated to The Office. And this is one of the big questions. You know, it was Toby the Scranton Strangler? I believe that he was. So some of the questions they ask, Jeff, where was Toby during the Scranton Strangler police chase? When everybody's in the office and they're watching, everybody's there, Toby's not there. Toby was on the Scranton Strangler jury and was overly eager to break the rules about sharing undisclosed information. Toby publicly denounces the guilty verdict. And even after the trial, Toby continues to fixate on the strangler. Then he visits, quote unquote, the real killer in jail, and that ends in violence. So, and then the whole thing where he touched Pam's leg and then escaped to Costa Rica and then apparently got injured, whether it was a broken neck or something, and he said he had a zip lining accident, something went down. And really, most of all, whatever happened to Toby's wife? Toby's got this little girl, he's got a daughter, but where's the wife? I don't know. There's a lot of evidence right there that seems to point directly to Toby being the strangler.
Well, and one of the things you forgot is when they're doing the chase with the Scranton Strangler, they look outside and they see they're watching the video where you see the police car. And then later in the show, you see Toby get into a car and it's the same car that was involved in the chase.
Right.
So I think the evidence is pretty compelling that he was, in fact, the Scranton Strangler. So. Next question, and boy, is this a hot button topic if you're a fan of The Office. Barry, Jim Halpert, heel or babyface?
Oh, so I think I spent the entire run of the show thinking that Jim was the ultimate babyface. Positive guy, in love with Pam, likes to have fun, but he's the everyman. We can all relate to Jim. However, much like the whole is Toby the Scranton Strangler, if you get onto YouTube or you get onto any of the Reddit sites or the Ranker sites, there are a lot of compelling evidence here that's being put forth that he's a heel, that he's an absolute heel. He was terrible to Karen, and I loved Karen, by the way. That's another character that, and I think we talked about her last week or the week before, but huge crush on Rashida Jones. I think she's a fine actress. I think she's very attractive. I liked her a lot. I followed her to Parks and Recreation. That's how much I actually liked her, but he treated her like shit. You know, he secretly invested his family savings in his bro job. He broke up with Katie on a boat, Katie being Amy Adams, who neither of us have discussed, but I really liked her as well.
She was the lady that sold handbags.
She sold wonderful handbags. Jim decides to move to Philadelphia after he and Pam have kids. That's a nice thing. Just, you know, do it. He gets everyone to make fun of Michael's script, if you remember Threat Level Midnight.
Classic.
Yeah, exactly. That's a good one. Here's one. And Jeff, you've been married multiple times, and you're certainly in a relationship now for many years. Coincidentally, I celebrate my 20th wedding anniversary tomorrow, which I'm
shocked. Shout out to Mrs. Rose, by the way.
Oh, absolutely. And you know what? Absolutely. She should get some sort of award for this. But he bought a house without telling Pam. I mean, what? I can't go get lunch without telling my wife. He bought a house without telling Pam.
Mrs. Rose would have gone for that, Barry.
No, I don't think Mrs. Rose would have. In any form, he convinced Pam to drop out of art school.
his work ethic could certainly be called into play, but I won't get on him for that one. His torturing of Dwight, I won't get on him for that one. But he might have cheated on Pam. And that yes. one, I don't know. That's, yeah. So I don't really know. So I'm going to say, Jim was a tweener, but he's more of a heel than a babyface.
He's kind of a Dory Funk Jr. world champion. You know, he can work heel or babyface. And you know, one of the great things about it, again, as I talked about the different deep dives you can do on this show on YouTube, is there's all these theories about how many people in the office slept with one another. Because, you know, one of the theories is that Pam's former fiance, Roy, had an affair with Angela before they yep. ended up breaking up. There's, you know, and then there's a theory that Stanley and Phyllis had apparently hooked up. So this was a very many tentacled office where so many people were sleeping with so many people. It was just kind of crazy. So, yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think Jim Halpert definitely started off as the lead babyface, ended up becoming a tweener. And I think at the end, he was redeemed as a babyface. But, yeah, here, I won't go and spoil anything, Barry, but I got to tell you something. When they had that kid, and even before, and I'll talk about that later, but, oh, my God, anytime you add a kid to a good TV show, it usually just kills the show, Barry.
It does. So if we're talking – it is funny, too, because – and I know exactly where this can wind up leading to, but we just talked about characters that are the breakout star. But then there's the desperation act when you're on a show, and usually adding a child is like a form of desperation. Okay, something isn't working. Our audience is down by 30%. You know, we're going to fucking throw a kid into the show and see what happens. And then the show invariably is canceled the next 2 years.
Do you know what the original – example of that was, this is a real
it was the Brady Bunch.
Yes, Oliver joined. Cousin yeah. Oliver, absolutely. Yeah, the death knell for that TV show.
Killed
okay,
killed it.
Yeah, next question, very important. Also, question, Barry, which episode of The Office was the jump the shark episode? Where did it start its downward slide?
Oh, I'm going to say season 7, I believe it started its downward slide, but it officially jumped the shark on season 8. And season 8, Michael was gone. The show was focusing on Andy, and you know, Andy was a manager now, and Andy was another guy. I think that's the only name that we haven't mentioned. There's another name that we haven't mentioned. But when Andy was in small doses, Andy was fine. Andy now has moved into the Michael Scott role, and he's the focus of the show, and it didn't work for me. Nellie becoming a manager, again, not a fan of Nellie. Robert California. Now, James Spader, you and I discussed James Spader in one of our early episodes, and we talked about Tough Turf, which really is just a kick-ass movie if you've never seen it. But James Spader is also a guy that could be something about him can rub you the wrong way, at least for me it does. And to me, he was at his most annoying as Robert California. I just didn't like it. I thought it was this was your cousin Oliver in a sense. Instead of a little kid, you're throwing in James Spader right now. So season 8, it officially jumped for me. It started in 7 and maybe even 6 a little bit. The first 5 years, I think, were gold. And people always, there's a mixed reaction on season 1. Was it good? Was it bad? And it certainly wasn't the best. But 2, 3, 4, and 5, I think, were stellar. 6 was good. 7, slide begins. 8, you're fully in the fucking trenches right now. That's my opinion.
Okay, your opinion is wrong. Because I will tell nice. You that the show, which for season 1, again, up and down, 2, 3, 4, absolute Hall of Fame worthy episodes. And then at the end of season 4, it was goodbye Toby. And that was the last episode of season 4. And for me, right off the cliff they started. Now, I will say this. From seasons 5 and 6, they had good episodes. They had shining lights in the darkness, okay? There were a few very funny episodes. And, you know, one of the things I thought, and I think I mentioned this to you, as I was looking through the entire series of episodes, Their finale, which took place on May 16th, 2013 on IMDb, which is my go-to reference point, earned a 9.7 out of 10, which is absolutely incredible. And it was a great episode that will not be in either one of our top fives, by the way. But it's a great episode because it was a great wrap-up to the show, and they did an outstanding job. But those kind of episodes between seasons 5, 6, 7, and 8 and end of 9, to me, were just few and far between. Whereas 2, 3, and 4, literally every – you know, we got our top five favorite episodes. Literally every episode during one of those three seasons could have easily been in my top five.
Yeah, and I gotta, you know, look, when I start doing my top five list, I think I'm really episodes I'm in seasons 2, 3, or 4. So I get that. You know, here was the thing with The Office too. You didn't always have to have a great storyline for me. A lot of it was seeing the characters every week, and they become quote unquote your friends. You know, you're happy to see Jim and Pam and Kevin and Stanley and Phyllis. So the storyline sometimes, in my opinion, almost becomes second nature. It's I just want to see them just converse with each other and just, you know, have a conversation, whatever it is. I think what unfortunately happened, some of these storylines became really stupid and really just kind of too outrageous. But I think season 6 still had some good stuff.
No, in 5 and 6, there were still certain episodes that I thought were very funny episodes. But to me, the Goodbye Toby episode, that is where Holly Flax came in. And I'm not blaming the demise of the series on Holly Flax's character, but that is where things began to take a precipitous slip in quality to me. And it just happened to coincide with her. I happen to, you know, she was a goofy character that I like. But again, Kathy Bates coming in, Will Ferrell came in, you know, all these other actors that came in, and every person that came in had to have some kind of weird quirk about them. Instead of just having, as you said, Jim, the everyman, Pam was really pretty much an everywoman. You know, somebody, she wasn't drop dead beautiful, but she was cute. And it was somebody that you could root for. And women, she wasn't the drop dead beautiful woman that, you know, that maybe another woman might be, you know, like, oh, that bitch. But, you know, she was wholesome enough to where she wasn't like a threat. She was, you know, good looking enough to where you could, you know, find her interesting. And Holly Flax, when she came in, was another character, but she had to be like Michael. She was kind of quirky. And I was kind of getting to the point where I was done with every new character coming in having certain quirks to them. And to me, it just got a little bit tiresome. So, Barry, let me just ask you, compare, if you've had a chance to see, what did you think about the UK version? Because I got to tell you, our fans over in the UK, I'm sure, are sitting there saying, oh, the American version is complete crap compared to the UK version, because the UK version with Ricky Gervais, who was one of the creators of the whole storyline and the episodes or the show itself. What did you think of the UK version?
Yeah, so I wasn't a big fan. And I think partly I saw the UK version maybe some 4 years after watching The Office. So when I first turned it on, I wasn't able to connect. I'm not the biggest Ricky Gervais fan. For some reason, I'm just, I don't know. I don't connect with him. So I don't want to offend any of our UK listeners, because they're out there. There, you know, we actually have plenty of UK listeners, which I'm sometimes very shocked and surprised by. But no, just not. I was never able to connect with it.
And I saw it, and I thought it was a good show. I did not think it was the equal of the U.S. show. But, you know, in all fairness, I too also began watching the UK version after I'd already been, you know, hooked on the American version, and I wanted to see it and compare it. I like some of Ricky Gervais's stuff. Some stuff I don't like. I wouldn't say I'm a huge fan of his, but, you know, I like some of the stuff that he's done. I think also it might, you know, it lasted basically one season. I think it ran maybe 6, 8, 10 episodes at the most. So you really didn't have time to get yourself emotionally involved in the characters the way you did with the American version. So, okay. So now we have finally reached the point, Barry. It is time for us to reveal our top five episodes of The Office, and the folks on the Breaking Kayfabe message board are waiting with bated breath. Barry, why don't you offer up your number five favorite episode of The Office?
Yeah, I got to say, too, though, this is hard because, You and I both.
That's what she
that.
Said. Well,
anyway. Yeah, that is perfect, perfect reference. But you know, when you sent me your list, I mean, my God, it's, you know, that's, there's just gold right there. But there's so many good episodes. So for me, my number five was Gay Witch Hunt. Did you ever see Gay Witch Hunt?
I've seen
I know
them.
You have. Absolutely. So it's this. Yeah, the season three premiere, to me, it was great. It begins with Michael basically making a homophobic comment at Oscar, and then he learns that Oscar is gay, and Michael then wants to make it up to him. And, of course, Michael, you know, doing everything the wrong way, holds this ill-advised sensitivity seminar, and really in one of the best moments on the show, he kisses Oscar full on the lips. I just thought that was so funny, too. This is also the first episode that Karen Filippelli, played by the lovely Rashida Jones, is in. And I think also Andy Bernard, it's also his first episode. But this was the episode that I mentioned, and the whole gay witch hunt thing. And Michael is so, he's so awkward in the way that he deals with everything. But Creed has got one of the great lines in this. And he goes, Creed says, "I'm not offended by homosexuality. In the 60s, I made love to many, many women, often outdoors in the mud and the rain, and it's possible a man slipped in there. There would be no way of knowing." And I just was like, when I heard that, I was like, oh my God, that's so Creed when he says that. So this is such a funny episode, and this is one that I think really typifies Michael. This is a Michael Scott episode.
You know, one of the things I've often tried to explain and explaining to someone the character of Michael Scott, I think the word that I use is obtuse, because he's so just not – he does not understand certain things, but he thinks he understands everything. So he's dumb, but he doesn't realize he's dumb. And there's sometimes he's dumb and he's very entertaining. There's sometimes he's dumb and he's very offensive. But Michael has a great line in this when he goes over to Oscar, and, you know, Oscar has, you know, come out and revealed that he is in fact gay. And Michael says, you know, but Oscar says, "It's okay. Don't worry about it." And Michael is quoted as saying, no. "It's just, I feel terrible about it. I have been calling people faggy since I was junior high school, and I've never made that mistake. If I don't know how to behave, it's because I'm just so far the opposite way, you know? I can't even imagine the thing. Maybe you could go out for we could go out for a beer sometime, and you could tell me how you do that to another dude." And that's it's, you know, and he does not realize how offensive he's being. And, you know, the scene that you spoke of where he kisses Oscar, they did not tell the people that were sitting in the office with them, the actors, that they were going to do that. It was completely unrehearsed and spontaneous. So the reactions you see from the other actors are completely spontaneous and real. And that's what makes it just so funny.
Yeah, it really is too. And that's, you're 100% right too. And I had read that too, that they didn't have any idea that was going to happen. And you got to, you know, for them to jump in and do that too, with that full out kiss. And to me, again, it's typical Michael, in the way that he would handle a situation. I just thought that was great.
Yeah, very funny stuff. Okay, now my top five begins with an episode from January 5th. 2006. Before I go, Barry, I just want to mention your episode, Gay Witch Hunt. I wanted to give the ratings that IMDb offered. Gay Witch Hunt was came out on the 21st of September 2006. It got an 8.8 strong rating there, Barry. Yes, on the IMDb scale. My episode came out on January 5th, 2006, and it got an 8.6. And that episode is called Booze Cruise, and that was the one that we had referenced earlier, Barry, where Michael does his whole bit where he's pretending like he's on Titanic and reaching out there. And this episode is great because it continues the storyline with Jim and Pam, where Jim finally reveals his feelings for Pam to Michael, who, of course, being the obtuse idiot that he is, can't keep the secret and has to let everyone know. But what they do is they decide that they're going to have this motivational cruise on Lake, I don't know, some kind of Lake Wazapamani or something like that outside of Scranton. And, of course, it's the middle of winter, so everyone's literally freezing their asses off. And one of the great scenes is that Michael tells Dwight I need you to help the captain steer the ship. And he takes him up front. And there's a wooden steering wheel, of course, that doesn't do anything. And Dwight basically spends the entire trip on the lake thinking that he's steering the ship when he's not. So what did you think of Booze Cruise?
Yeah, it's really funny, too. And this was the one where that I referenced earlier, too, where Jim broke up with Katie, with Amy Adams, as they're on the boat, too. And, yeah, so it's a funny episode. You know, this is, you know, I think anything where you're, you know, you've got booze and you've got a boat, it's going to be funny. And this was, it was perfect.
Yeah, and there's, I think his name is Robert Riggleman, plays the captain of the ship, Robert Riggleman.
Robert, yeah.
Who's a veteran character actor who's been in he was in the movie Step Brothers. Yeah. Okay. Step Brothers. He played one of the guys that worked for Will Ferrell's brother who worked for the helicopter leasing company. Who's a big line in this room. Bam. Yeah. Bam. He kept doing that over and over again. It was very, very funny and very effective. He plays the captain. And of course, Michael Scott somehow does not understand that being the manager of the office is not the same as being the captain on the ship, and has to be reminded from time to time that he is not, in fact, the captain of the ship. The captain is the captain of the ship. But it's a very funny episode. Lots of, you know, the great thing about The Office, and we haven't discussed this, Barry, is the whole design of the show is its humor, but it's humor that makes you feel slightly uncomfortable. And that's something we haven't said. And that's one of the things that the really great episodes of this show do. You're laughing, but you're laughing while you're feeling extremely uncomfortable for the characters in the show.
Yeah, well, you're 100% right about that, too. And I'd fully agree with that. It's, you know, I think the one thing, whenever I watch The Office, there is that slight twist of it's like being at like an awkward Thanksgiving dinner with like your crazy uncle. In a sense, like there's something that's slightly off about it, but at the same time, you're almost grateful that you're there, you know?
Yeah. You're just, it's like, shit's going to hit the fan and I want to be there to watch it. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
Okay. You're number four.
My number four is The Secret. So this kind of piggybacks off right off of the Booze Cruise. And, this is the one, you know, now Jim has confessed, about the crush that he has on Pam to Michael, but now Jim is becoming desperate to make sure that Michael keeps the secret to himself. And of course, Michael says, for as long as I possibly can. And this was also where, you know, the secret was getting ready to come out that Oscar was gay, but there is a great line. Dwight Schrute has got a line in this movie, in this episode that I just thought was stellar. And Dwight goes, there are several different ways to tell if a perp is lying. The liar will avoid direct eye contact. The liar will cover part of his or her face with his hands, especially the mouth. The liar will perspire. Unfortunately, I spoke to Oscar on the phone, so none of this is useful. Which to me, that's exactly the way that Dwight would actually say something, you know? So, and that's another thing too that we haven't. The dialogue in this show is some of the very best, I think, that we have ever seen on television. And it was, so in taking a show like Seinfeld, where the comedy was much broader, because a lot of that was written, this wasn't done that way. And I think that a lot of the writing that we see in The Office truly was some of the best writing that you'll ever see for a television show. And you really can't call it a sitcom. I don't know if it's been called a sitcom, but it definitely, I don't think it was. It's a situational comedy, but it's not our traditional sitcom. But some of the lines are just fantastic. And when you start to do the research and you go back and you see these lines, you go, this is gold.
This episode came out on January 19th, 2006, an 8.3 rating, Barry, a little bit lower than the last one. So now it's, yeah, my number four episode came out on the 11th of May, 2006. And that episode was called Casino Night. Casino Night got a 9.2.
Wow.
Boom. One of the highest rated episodes of this show's history, Barry. And this, of course, was the episode where they're having a casino night to raise money for is this the one where they're raising money for the rabbit, or is that a completely different episode for people with rabies? But or I don't know, they're for some charity. I can't remember. But what happens is there's also all these storylines that converge. And this is the first time we get to see Jim and Pam. The secret romance is beginning to develop, and Pam is told by Jim that he's been in love with her, and he kisses her. She kisses him back, and she's engaged to Roy, the guy that works in the warehouse. And that is a big moment in the show's history and timeline. Barry, what did you think of Casino Night?
Well, so this Casino Night, really, that's a huge, what do you say, 9.2?
Yes.
Jeez, that's off the charts right there. So this was actually not only about Jim and Pam. This is the introduction of Kevin's Police tribute band, Scrantonicity.
That was Scrantonicity 1. Later,
exactly.
Scrantonicity 2 would be exposed. But and this was such a – apparently it was for the – they were doing something for the Boy Scouts. They were gambling there. And I believe there was a time in the show that Michael said he wanted to actually invite the Boy Scouts to come to the casino to accept the check, at which point he was told it probably wouldn't be a good idea to have a bunch of young boys come out in the middle of the night and the middle of the week also and receive a check for gambling proceeds. But there's also the storyline with Michael, his real estate agent, and good Lord, we haven't mentioned Jan Levinson-Gould. How did I miss her on my favorite minor characters? Jan Levinson-Gould, who plays Michael's boss, and Jan Levinson-Gould makes a pass at Michael at the end of the night. And there's just so many things going on in this episode and the wrap up and lead you into what happens the following season, Barry.
Yeah, and I think that's a good point, too, is that there are so many things happening. And this episode, if I'm correct, I think this was written by Steve Carell. It was either written or directed by him. It definitely, but there, every episode there was so much going on. And that's what I think I like about the show as well, is that, there was never this complacency effect in the early years. Certainly the last, even in the last couple of years, I don't think they were complacent. I think they were trying to throw as much shit up on the wall to see if any of it would actually stick. And, I think with Michael Scott being gone, with the glue being gone, they weren't able to do that. But, let me get on to my number three, Jeff. Because my number three for me brings into Prison Mike. So I'm talking about the convict. So what was the rating on the convict?
8.2, came out on November 30th, 2006.
Gotcha. So yeah, so this one I love. This is fun. And what I like is that one of the things I always liked about the show is when they would gather in the conference room for like one of the Michael's meetings or whatever the cause was. But I always felt that was always, we have an emergency meeting in the conference room, everybody in the conference room. So I thought this was really funny. And this was one that I watched last night. And, when Michael's channeling Prison Mike to tell everybody that prison was a lot scarier than they thought, I was actually laughing out loud. It's probably midnight last night. This is funny to me. And Michael's got this great line, his Prison Mike. He goes, "The worst thing about prison was the dementors. They were flying all over the place and they were scary. And then they'd come down and they'd suck the soul out of your body and it hurt." And I just, what the fuck does that mean? Right. And I just, that's what I like about it. He's so funny. And this one also had a really funny sight gag, where Dwight is bending over and he's got this big wad of cash coming out of his pocket. I just thought this was just such a funny episode. And there's nothing go for it.
No, I was just going to say the basis of the show was they have the new staff come down from the other branch and they find out that one of the guys that's come down has a prior prison record. And the guy apparently it was something like mortgage, some kind of mortgage stuff. And one of the great lines, of course, that Kevin says, it sounds a lot like stuff that I've been doing on my computer. And another great Kevin Malone line. But so anyway, so they are told by Jan Levinson-Gould that there is someone in their office that has a prison record. So Dwight and Michael are trying to figure out who the ex-convict is. And so so Michael says, this is a great quote, "Close your eyes. Picture a convict. What's he wearing? Nothing special, a baseball cap on backwards, baggy pants. He says something ordinary like, yo, that schnizzle. Okay, now slowly open your eyes. Who are you picturing? A black man? Wrong. That was a white woman. Surprised? Well, shame on you." And it's just when Michael tries to be the black guy, he's always just so great. And, this is just a stellar episode. You're absolutely right. And Dwight, of course, is revealed as being a volunteer Lackawanna Lackawanna County Sheriff's Deputy. Right.
That's right.
And he does not like people that break the law. That is for sure. So, okay, my number three is from May 17th, 2007. It's called The Job and received, Barry, 9.3.
Wow.
The Job. And this is where they all go to interview for the job at David Wallace's office, which is corporate in New York City. And Michael thinks he's got the job of, I guess he's going to be the regional manager, not realizing that the Jan Levinson Gould, the woman he's now dating, they're going to take her job away from her. So he goes up to apply for that job, not knowing that other members of the office on the sly are going up there also to apply. He feels like he's got it in the bag. And it's just, there's so much going on in this episode that is just so outrageous and so hilarious, Barry.
Yeah, too. And this is definitely a good one, too. And you're right. So Jan had no idea that she was going to be fired. But I love the car trip as they're heading up with Michael, Jim, and Karen going up to New York to actually to interview for this job. So I think that's great. This is, I think, the biggest moment probably in this episode is when, and apparently this is a parallel to something that occurred in the British version of The Office, when Jim at the end of the episode realizes how Pam has been this constant support system for him throughout their time together. And he travels back to Scranton, interrupting Pam's talking head interview, asks her out to dinner. And it just, there was a moment there where if you remember that expression on Pam's face, as Jim leaves the room, to me, it's just, you know, it's just everything that you want as the season is ending, because she's got this look of excitement, and it looked like she's been like emotionally touched. So this is such a great episode. What did you say they rank it?
And I think they gave it a 9.3. And I don't know if you know this, and this is another thing, because I've done a deep dive on the series. They did not tell Jenna Fischer that John Krasinski was going to come in character, of course, and asked that. So as she's being videotaped as Pam Beasley, Jim Halpert comes in, asks her out on a lunch date. So the reaction you see is a complete, you know, visceral reaction from Jenna Fischer playing Pam Beasley. And that's what makes it kind of even more special. great Dwight Schrute line in this. He says, once I'm officially regional manager, my first order of business will be to demote Jim Halpert. So I will need a new number two. My ideal choice, Jack Bauer, but he's unavailable, fictional, and overqualified. And that is
that's good.
There's so many great Dwight Schrute. But, you know, and one of the other things is the ride back. I'm not sure if that's on the same episode or not, where he's riding back. Michael is riding back with Jan, and Jan starts complaining about the boobs that she just had the implants put in and how they hurt. And he doesn't understand that. And you can just see Michael is just completely stressed out about the fact that he's latched himself off to this woman that he can't get rid of now. But just a really good episode. Again, all these stories converging. You know, another character, a great minor character for the first, I want to say, 3 or 4 years before he left the show. The character left the show, not the actor, is the character of David Wallace. And David Wallace was such a great straight man for the other actors in the show, Barry.
Yeah, he was a good actor, too. So I remember the episode, and I forget all the details, but the episode where he was fired and decided to start a garage band.
Yes.
Remember? And they go to visit him, and he's like in like a garage band with like his teenage son or somebody like that. Was good, funny. Though. David Wallace was good. He was, you know, that's, and I like Jan, too. It's Jan is, she's been acting in movies for 20 years at this point. Melora Hardin, I believe, is her real name.
Who was briefly brought up recently in an F. Mary or Kill, as I recall, Barry.
She was, absolutely. What was it in relation to?
It was women from The Office. We were doing
a
preview of this episode, Barry.
There so you go. That would make a lot of sense.
Give me your number two.
My number two would be The Injury. So let me know where that actually ranks.
The Injury came out on January 12, 2006. Barry, you will be very happy to know, 9.0.
All right. I was going to demand, I need a 9-something in on one of these. So this is one that, again, I watched this one last night when I pulled it up on demand too. And this is hysterical. Michael is burned his foot on the George Foreman grill, and he can't come in, and Dwight then rushes to assist him and crashes into an electric pole. He vomits and then keeps going to get him. The episode really centers around how Michael is really insensitive, self-centered, and a baby. And it's kind of funny because Dwight kind of goes in the opposite direction. Because he got a concussion from crashing into this pole, he becomes kind of cordial and friendly to everybody. It's just such a funny episode. But Michael's got this great line, and he goes, "I enjoy having breakfast in bed. I like waking up to the smell of bacon. Sue me. And since I don't have a butler, I have to do it myself. So most nights before I go to bed, I will lay 6 strips of bacon out on my George Foreman grill. Then I go to sleep. When I wake up, I plug in the grill. I go back to sleep again. Then I wake up to the smell of crackling bacon. It is delicious. It's good for me. It's the perfect way to start the day. Today I got up, I stepped onto that grill, and it clamped down on my foot. That's it. I don't see what's so hard to believe about that." It's like, all right. So the whole visual here of Michael Scott laying out bacon before he goes to sleep on a George Foreman grill, which is on the floor, and then him stepping on it, really is hysterical to me.
And one of the great scenes towards the end of this episode is Dwight, of course, sustains a concussion, wrecking his car, going to save Michael. So the office realizes that something's happened to Dwight, that he needs to get to a hospital to be examined, to have an MRI, to see if he has a concussion. And so Michael agrees to take him. So Michael takes him, and they're putting Dwight on the MRI machine. And as they're getting ready, and Dwight is wheeled in or whatever at the MRI machine or put in, and Michael lifts up his leg and puts his foot in so he can get his MRI, the MRI on his foot too. And the nurse says, sir, can you please take your foot down? And Michael is just disgusted that all this attention is being focused on Dwight instead of him. And it makes him absolutely crazy.
Yeah, which is typical Michael, right?
Of course. So now it is time for my number two. My number two occurred on November 15th, 2007. And that is an episode which received an 8.7, Barry, and that is The Deposition. The Deposition is when Jan Levelson Gould had been fired by Dunder Mifflin Incorporated, and so she is having Michael deposed to testify against the company that he works for, which puts him in a extremely awkward position, of course. And, I briefly commented, Barry, one of the things the show is built around is Michael's proclivity. I think it's the first time we said proclivity here on Breaking Kayfabe, and obviously I had a little trouble. His proclivity for saying, "That's what she said," when anything remotely sexual is said. And so during the deposition, when he's asked different things and particular phrases or words are used, in the middle of the deposition, he'll say, "That's what she said." At which point the lawyers go, "What did he say?" He says, "That's what she said." And nobody understands except Jan what Michael is doing. And they have the court reporter read back the "That's what she said" portion. And what's great is Toby is there. And Toby makes a great comment about he's waiting for the inevitable class action lawsuit for a male subordinate suing his female superior for it. And it was just really, really funny stuff.
Isn't this the one, too, where Daryl and Jim are playing ping pong? And it turns into like this big competition. I think
yes,
this is
between
the same
Pam
episode.
And Kelly.
Yeah, exactly, with Pam and Kelly too. Yeah, this is a really, really fun episode as well. So let me ask you a question. And Daryl's a guy that we haven't really mentioned. What do you think of Daryl?
I thought Daryl was a good I'm trying to think, what was the actor, a comedian who was on the show for the first couple of seasons, and died. It was a guy that used to be on all the roasts on Comedy Central, and I can't for the life of me think of his name.
Greg Giraldo?
No. It was a black guy who was Craig Robinson is the actor who played Daryl.
Oh yeah. And, Jesus Christ! I don't
Patrice
know.
O'Neill.
I don't think.
Patrice O'Neill.
That's it. Yeah.
Obviously, our producer is listening to Breaking Kayfabe tonight. Shout out to the great Brian Last. Thanks for that heads up. Patrice O'Neill. It was a great dynamic between those two. And he later, he became more of a integral character as the show. And he wasn't one that I really had a problem with. I liked the character of Daryl. He wasn't certainly annoying to the level of some of the other characters. He did not have as many quirks. He was more of a regular guy. So that's why he was more of an acceptable character to me. But yeah, this episode, it, for as much as you remember the ping pong, the stuff that happens while Michael is being deposed is just next level great stuff, Barry.
Yeah, did you ever see a Hot Tub Time Machine, which Craig Robinson stars in? Yeah, and actually Clark Duke, who is another character that we haven't mentioned.
He came much later in the show.
Yeah, he did. He came towards the end when you know the show obviously was on its, I guess, on life support. It's probably the best way to put it. But that's a really, really funny movie, though.
The first one was good. The second one was a complete train wreck. So that's great line from Michael Scott in this particular episode. He says, "You expect to get screwed by your company, but you never expect to get screwed by your girlfriend." Talking about Taylor. Okay, awesome. Barry, it is time. Give us your number one favorite episode of The Office.
Yeah, this is so, you know, look, you've picked out some great ones on your list. And when I saw your list, I'm like, fuck, man, you took like the five best. But I think this one is arguably one of the best of all time. And I'm going to come off with a line. It's from Pam. You know what they say about a car wreck where it's so awful you can't look away? The Dundies are like a car wreck that you want to look away from, but you have to stare at it because your boss is making you. So for me, it's the Dundies, Jeff. It's to me, this is kind of, if I was going to show one episode to somebody, the Dundies, I think, would be it. It is such a great episode. Where did that rank? That's got to be up in the nines.
That was given an 8.7. The episode debuted on the 27th of September, 2005. And but no, you're absolutely right. The course, the Dundies taking place at Chili's in Scranton.
Taking it at Scranton Chili's, yes. And this was the year that that everybody discovered that the company will not be paying for food or drinks.
That's right.
You'll be paying your own way at the office at the Dunder Mifflin Dundies. So I thought that was really funny. This is really, really good. Because I think this is Michael on display right here. He is, you know, his jokes, which are all lame, the imitations he's doing, which are horrific. He's got this man crush on Ryan, which is super, super obvious. And this is also the episode. This is the one where Pam, who was very drunk, kissed Jim. And she was engaged at the time.
That's right. And I wanted to give a quick Michael Scott quote from this episode. The tight ass award goes to Angela, not only because she is everyone's favorite stickler, but because she has a great caboose. So come on down. Okay, so now it is time for my number one favorite episode. And, you know, I mentioned briefly a couple minutes ago that one of the great things about the show was the way that they made you laugh while also making you feel super uncomfortable. And it was just such a gift that they had in the show. And for me, my favorite episode of all time took place on the 10th of April, 2008. And that, Barry, is The Dinner Party. The Dinner Party got a 9.3, which I believe, other than the final, the final episode, was possibly the highest rated episode ever. The Dinner Party is where members of the office come over to Jan and Michael's apartment, which is, that's just a whole different story right there, Barry, the stuff that happens in that apartment. But Jan and Michael's relationship, let's just put it lightly, has begun to fracture, and cracks are seen in the facade of the relationship. And they get over, and Jan has apparently been drinking, which of course makes it even better. And among the gems that happens is this is Jan, who when she was working for corporate, apparently had a young assistant named Hunter. And Hunter, at the time that he was working for Jan, was a young man that had not experienced the love of an old adult woman who could teach him the ways of sexual activity and make him more experienced. And so he sang a song for Jan, or he put it on record. And what was it called, Barry? Like just One Night was the name of the song.
Right.
And she plays the song and begins dancing very provocatively, at least drunken provocatively. And the lyrics of the song are go something like, you know, you took me by the hand and you made me a man. And poor Michael has to sit there and listen to this song, which is about how his girlfriend is nailing this young kid. And it's absolutely a laugh riot.
Yeah, it was really, really funny, too. And so you said it early on, too. This is so uncomfortable to watch this whole episode. And it is like we're almost like we're voyeurs in watching this episode, but Jim's got a great line here. It's Michael and Jan seem to be playing their own separate game, and it's called "Let's see how uncomfortable we can make our guests," and they're both winning. So, and that's what it is. It's super uncomfortable. So of all of the relationships that Michael had, and I got to say, I really loved Holly. I actually, there was something there. And I love Jan, though. That's where I was going to go with this. But when he and Holly got together, I actually believed it. Like, it was one of those, like, suspension of disbelief. You know, I know they're actors and I know they're on a TV show, but it seemed so real. And I thought it was really, really done well. But I enjoyed his relationship with Jan because it was so much of it was truly uncomfortable.
Yeah. And here is the classic scene with Michael Scott discussing with Jan, and they're arguing back and forth, but they're doing it very passive aggressively. And so at one point, Jan makes some sort of comment. And this is after the Hunter song has finished. And Michael says, quote, "When I said that I wanted to have kids and you said you wanted me to have a vasectomy, what did I do? And then when you said that you might want to have kids and I wasn't so sure, who had the vasectomy reversed? And then when you said you definitely didn't want to have kids, who had it reversed back? Snip, snap, snip, snap, 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 snap. I did. You have no idea the physical toll that three vasectomies have on a person." That whole quote was referenced on our board today, and it reminded me what a great scene that was. And then Michael later, she throws one of his Tundies into his plasma TV, which is like 16 inches. It's like the world's smallest plasma TV. And he looks at her, he says, "That is a $200 plasma screen TV that you killed. Good luck paying me back with your $0 a year salary plus benefits, babe." And we haven't even got into the bedroom where Michael is forced to sleep on an ottoman because Jan likes to spread out in the bed. Oh my God, Barry, I love this friggin' episode. It's so hilarious. We haven't even got into the fact that Dwight shows up with his former babysitter as his date. Oh yes. God, I love this episode and I love this show.
I'm going to have to watch this one tonight then, because we're sitting here and you're jogging in my memory with this episode, and it's I'm going to have to go on and watch that. So
Then of course, just before we leave, I will mention also Dwight Schrute, who I mentioned earlier, volunteer Lackawanna County Sheriff's deputy, walks out. There's a brouhaha. Everyone's leaving the apartment. Dwight comes out and he says to everybody else, he says, "I'll take care of this. Okay. What seemed to be the problem, officers?" And the cop says, right, "Not now, Dwight." Because they all know Dwight, what a pain in the ass he is. Oh my God. I could sit here for another 10 minutes and talk about this episode, but the great Brian Lass is going to kill us. Barry, anything before we leave? Folks, go out and watch The Office.
Exactly. That's exactly what I'm going to do tonight. No, it's all good. This is another action-packed episode. What are we doing next week, Jeff?
We are going to discuss a match that I consider one of the two greatest matches I've ever seen in my life live. Boom! And we will be offering the remainder of the great questions that were asked to us on our Breaking Kayfabe message board. And we are going to put Barry Rose's feet to the fire and see if he knows the answers to those questions, because he doesn't know the questions. I sound like I'm doing a Karnak routine now, Barry. So, Barry, that about it for now. Are you ready to go out and celebrate your anniversary?
That's it. I'm good. Anniversary. My daughter is 20 years married. Daughter is 14 years old. And, I'm super excited. And we're going on vacation, too, which is why we're taping all these shows in a cluster. But, I'm very excited. But I'm looking forward to next week.
Have a great vacation. Happy birthday to Zoe, who we saw up there on her surfboard. I saw some photos that you posted. So big thumbs up to Zoe. So you can follow me on Twitter at Baldrin Jeff. Breaking Kayfabe is, in fact, a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network, the great Brian Last. And until next time, we're going to come back and we're going to do more Breaking Kayfabe on live!